You've heard it every way. A dog will have his day. But when it comes to wailing, dogs ain't got a thing to say. So they can do the waiting, cause I ain't hesitating. The future's round the corner, so for now I'm gonna play. Now's the time to wail. Not later, but right now's the time.
That's Elvira Vi Red on alto sax, wailing away, and of course with vocals with Now's the Time, written by Charlie Parker, who was a great influence on her and with whom she was quite close. That's from her 1962 album Bird Call, saluting Charlie Bird Parker. Vi Red, the daughter of New Orleans jazz drummer Alton Red, was active in the 50s and 60s and a distinctive contributor to the bebop, hard bop, and post-bop jazz movements of that time. She toured the U.S., Europe, and Africa extensively and was a featured instrumentalist with the Count Basie Band. She later formed her own. Needless to say, as a female sax player, she was one of very, very few women of note on the music scene at that time. But she stopped performing for some reason in 1963 and decided to devote her full attention to teaching music, another love of hers. There aren't many recordings of her, consequently. She's still going strong, I'm told, at 85, living in Los Angeles, California. And on that album, we heard Roy Ayers on vibes, Carmel Jones on trumpet, Russ Freeman on piano, Leroy Vinegar on bass, and her husband, Richie Goldberg, on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, August the 27th. And protest over the August 9th police killing of Michael Brown continued yesterday, a day after his burial, but with a change of venue to City Hall in downtown St. Louis. There, protesters demanded the arrest and prosecution of police officer Darren Wilson for killing Brown and a transparent investigation of another police killing 10 days later after Brown's death, that of 25-year-old Kajimi Powell, just 4 miles from Ferguson. Witnesses described Powell as pacing and acting erratically outside a convenience store. Cell phone video recorded two officers firing several rounds at Powell within seconds of arriving on the scene. Police reports said he had taken 2 power drinks and a couple of donuts from the store and that he was holding a knife when they encountered him outside. Eyewitnesses said he posed no threat to the officers but appeared to be very, very disturbed about something, and he was no threat to the police or anyone else. Ferguson has become a stark symbol of the dissonance between the America that is pridefully, I can't read my own writing here, talked about, and the America that is. In this month of August, the predominantly African-American small town has jarred the conscience and attention of the nation, placing at front and center once again the centrality of race and race oppression in America. So our discussion today involves a dialogue on the question, what has Ferguson taught you? Based on what you have gathered from this program and others, what you have gleaned on your own, and your own innate understanding and your own appreciation for American history and just plain life in your own experience. What has Ferguson taught you so far? Of course, it's still an evolving situation there and in the Fergusons of America. Ferguson, as you know, is now a symbolic metaphor for what has been going on in small areas of America all so many years, so many decades. Your calls at 888-874-4888. I want us to as much as we can on the really sincere understanding of things. It's not about a bloodletting, pointing fingers, who is guilty and who is innocent. But we're trying to understand what your assessment is, what informs it, and you know how your view is shaped by what so far has occurred and your ability to make sense of it or not make sense of it, how it has come to you, and in the larger sense, how this process, where does it place you within the scheme of things that we call America? We refer a lot on this program to political consciousness, and I guess in a way we're talking about that too. What is your political consciousness? And this is not just, it's not a black thing. We all have a political consciousness. So the discussion here on this Progressive Radio Network forum is to really talk among ourselves and to devote a substantial amount of time to that so that we can exchange information and feelings and our understandings, our shared beliefs, our questions, our doubts. But focusing on this issue of the centrality of race, and we see how we just can't escape it. It is so central to American life, the American story. What is that for you? What is it that this whole experience is teaching you? And how does that situate you to continue your life in the United States? How does it position you with respect to the spheres of influence in which you operate? What, therefore, is your attitude now? Is it changing? And if so, how? All these kinds of questions we should be talking about today. 888-874-4888. From New York City, let's start with Veronica.
Good day.
Hello.
I'm looking at the whole picture of what is going on throughout the world, and I see that the political parties have different people fighting amongst each other, whereas the only way that we can survive is if we do as the Montgomery bus boycott did. If we can shop with our own businesses, because the only thing that white supremacy understands is economics. So we must shop no longer in businesses that do not provide services. That is the reason why they can take tax dollars and choose to pay overtime to officers in Ferguson and throughout the nation where they're doing things wrong. Even when we decide to go out to these places, we are supporting businesses that uphold white supremacy.
Well, so, let me ask you right there, Veronica, to elaborate on this issue. how do you link, or why do you link, white supremacy to what happened in Ferguson and is happening in Ferguson? How do you rationalize that? What is the link that you make there?
Well, the fact that they are willing to pay $40,000 in overtime to police officers with all the people's tax-paying dollars instead of arresting one officer and having him go through the system as he should,
But why is that white supremacy as opposed to the way a system typically would answer what it perceives to be a threat to itself, the system just being the system?
The system must support the Constitution, and the Constitution itself is a racist document, and it is continuing upon the same people that wrote it, the same people that own slaves. So I even look at the fact that there were 52 Democrats and 48 Republicans who decided they would jump ship. So what's the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats? No difference. I see that it is a system of organized people. I reflect on a little history. I could even go to a Korean would not go and vend with a Japanese because they understand and they know the history. And as I see it, the successes is what we have to reproduce. And the one success that I could think of in modern times is 50 years later, there's no white business in Montgomery, Alabama, because we shopped, we bartered, and we made sure that we would service businesses that supported us. If we continue to shop with people that continue to feed the system, we are supplying our own monies, and we are contributing to our own oppression.
Well, Veronica, very well said today. Thank you so much for your call.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Also from New York City, Joel, you're on the air. Thank you.
Hello.
Hello, Joel.
How are you?
As I say, you fleet of foot.
I first want to apologize. I think I'm losing my voice. I hope I can be heard.
You certainly can.
Okay.
What is Ferguson teaching you?
Well, you know what? I hope I can answer your question in a way that is satisfying, but I'd like to approach it a little bit more indirectly, because while this stuff has been going on, I took a look at a couple of really important historic reports that were written about previous insurrections of African-American populations in our country, and I looked at the Carnegie Endowment report written by a Swedish sociologist named Gunnar Myrdal back in 1944 during the Second World War, called An American Dilemma. And then I reread parts, because it was very, very long, of the Kerner Commission report 25 years later in 1968. And, you know, what amazes me is that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
The same criticisms that people are making now, of course, were made then. But what the thing that that both reports mention and that I think might have some real value for us today is that sometimes when these insurrections take place, there's a sense of the isolation of the community from the broader community, that this is taking place within an African American community that is isolated from the larger society, and in some respects, that is a good definition of what ghettoization really is. But both reports plea for a recognition that this is an American problem. It is an American dilemma, and not simply a dilemma faced by African-American people confronting, militarized police. And so it's ironic that both reports call for the participation of organized labor, for instance, in these in these events. And what is amazing, as I look at what has happened now, is where was the AFL and CIO while all of this has been going on in these two cities, but certainly all over the country? I mean, their reaction was anemic. It was lame. And I remember back in 1963 when I participated in many civil rights demonstrations in New York City, in Boston, Philadelphia, and Chicago, most of which were about housing discrimination and education. Labor was there. Now, I know that labor has lost much of its authority, much of its power and influence over the last 25 years, but it had lost a lot of influence in 1963 as well. We were 15 years into the Taft-Hartley Act, which had really decimated labor. And yet there were still lots of local affiliates who went out there and who were in effect saying that this is not just, and this is amazing because a lot of this was over job discrimination, where a lot of these construction workers were members of the AFL-CIO. But of course, there was so much nepotism in those years, and African-Americans and Hispanics were being kept out. And yet, labor affiliates put themselves out on the line. Where are they today? And it's not just labor unions. I think we have to reflect upon the entire progressive culture and really demand that we see this as an American dilemma and not simply as a parochialized dilemma that simply confronts African-Americans. Because once we see that, we can recognize that we need a new kind of politics in this country, what the French call front populaire, popular front, because we have strength in numbers. And I said this on this program before, and I'll say it again. The only way that we can confront this kind of tyranny is to get out there in our hands and feet and to begin organizing. And the other thing that I wanted to say about this, because it's also mentioned in both the Carnegie Endowment Report and in the Kerner Report, that there's a difference between mobilization and organizing. And, you know, going back to the early 60s and even before that, someone like King or someone like Gandhi, they were the prototypes of what a mobilization should be all about. But the most important thing after King left the community was to organize. That's why SNCC was so important, because we were so preoccupied with organizing. So I think that, you know, once all of the drama is over and once Sharpton and the others realize the civil settlement, which the Brown family surely will get, that's when the real struggle really begins. And that struggle is going to require a community of interest on the part of all socially progressive and just-minded people to recognize that we have to work together. And if we don't do that, then I'm afraid that the racial divide that exists in this country will continue to exist. And there's precedent for this. I wanted to just say that in 1946, the CIO, when it was still a radical organization, took on the task of organizing the South and many black workers in the South. It didn't succeed, but at least they were out there trying. We really have to do it again. And if we do something like this, we can have an ameliorating effect on the labor unions, which are wallowing in corruption and in indifference right now. Okay.
Thank you so much, Joel. Thank you.
You're
very,
welcome.
Very thoughtful. Thank you.
Right.
From Queens, today, New York City is leading the way. Queens, James, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, Lisa.
Good afternoon.
And I like
what
to
has,
say...
What has Ferguson been teaching you?
Well, number one...
How do you relate to it?
I think in many cases you have to take a look at the police department. It's right here in New York. The good examples. Look at the writing on that police car. Those three words, courtesy and respect. And you ask yourself a question, who do they really respect? Because number one, you got black officers now that are in the police. What side are they standing when they see blacks being shot down, being killed? And on top of it, you say, wait a minute, where's the justice? Now the issue is, well, you got black on black crime, and you got the crime on both sides. And the question is, well, those young kids out here being killed, they're being sacrificed. And we hear these songs, civil rights people come along and say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and we're going to change this, and we're going to do this. Now, look at the mayor failed to really correct the commissioner. And when a commissioner failed to correct the police, well, you ask yourself a question, what is the mayor? What power does he have? What is the governor? No one wants to take the blame for the issue of not correcting a force that's out of control. Now you have a situation where police is given the power to use military. I mean, you go back to the issue that happened when the case on the college campus, and National Guard fired on young children. I mean, not young children, but students, because they were protesting. And the question comes up now that when people go out here and protest, well, there's a way of handling a crowd. At one time, you had a National Guard, you had the reserves, and you had the Army. Since the Army's being sort of being cut to the bone of, name, well, we don't need the National Guard anymore. Now we can get rid of the reserves. So now who protects the public? So now the power is given to the police now to protect. Now you give them military, you train them as SWAT, and you say, wait a minute. Now you're actually saying to the average American, look at this, and they say, wait a minute, they're supposed to protect us? Now the question comes up, well, now you're giving them more firepower. Police officer at one time had a 38, no more. He's given a 9-millimeter gun. Next thing, M16. So in the sense that what took place in the area where those young kids were protesting and then turn around and turn on the press, well, now you have no more constitution law no more.
Do you feel, James, you're in New York City, do you feel overwhelmed by police? Do you feel that the police are out of control in the city of New York?
Well, when Kelly was in charge, the police was under control. It was going to the pack that they're out of, to the point that it's like a culture. You have a white and you got black. These two images that are in the police force, as you see it now, they don't agree with one another. The media doesn't cover it because they're being muzzled. But the average black officer that works for the NYPD, they're in a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And the question comes up, well, wait a minute, who do I take my orders from? Well, I'm supposed to be a lieutenant, I'm supposed to be this. Well, no, you really have no power at all. Because they tell you what to do. You have no control. I mean, the neighborhoods that they police. Does a black officer ever get a chance to patrol his own black community? No. It's the whites are patrolling, and they patrol in another community, the white community. So in a sense that the mayor has failed to correct this, and when the problems pop up, who's to blame? Not the commissioner, but the mayor, because he's in charge. The mayor claimed he was going to stop and frisk. Now, all of a sudden, now he made a word, didn't do it. Can you trust these people? And I think in many cases, the public has to wake up and not listen to the propaganda. Because they always
Thank
come
you,
back
James.
And say, well, you got to get out and vote. You don't like that guy, you vote. Well, who are you going to vote for? Who can you trust today? So much corruption in the police. Government, state, the ethics. The governor got rid of the ethics. Why? Because no one wants to be correct anymore. Everybody wants to be, I want to be the guard. I want to be this one. I want to be the law and order. But no one wants to follow the laws at all. So they're being judged out of their own books. As a good book say, you're going to be judged.
Thank you, James, for
Thank
your
you.
Call today. Thank you very much for your contribution. From Montreal, we have Rudy. You're on the air.
Hello, Lutrisa. I'm calling because we've had problems in Canada, too, but it seems that the police are becoming more reasonable because people protested the deaths, unjustified deaths of certain people at the hands of police. But what I'd like to say is officers, the people want to be called officers, but they don't realize that there's a word that precedes that, and that's peace officer. Well, peace officers don't murder, really, or shouldn't. Now, there's a situation a previous caller talked about, economics. Instead of the city having to pay any settlement, why doesn't it come out, the monies come out from the assets of the police, like the pension funds and future revenues and assets, instead of the city forcing the taxpayers to pay for this? It's not the taxpayers that did the nasty deeds. It is the police. So they should be themselves required to pay for what damage they have done. Now, everybody talks about the state of the mind of the youth killed, but nobody asks what was the state of the mind of the police upon receiving the call. Like pilots, they should have to record everything that goes on in the car between them. I could just imagine what they might have said to each other. Hey, here's a chance to use the gun. I haven't used it in a while, and it's really oiled up. Maybe that's this is just what I'm saying. But, and the other thing that bothered me is there was a video showing the police looking at the person who was killed. And a normal human being, if somebody's in distress, would try to help them. The policeman went there, looked at the guy, and then he adjusted his holster, which says to me that what he's saying to him, what he's saying to himself is, hey, if this guy's not dead, I'm going to make sure I have my gun ready to wipe him out, to make sure he's dead. That's how I feel.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your call.
You're
I appreciate
very
it. Bye-bye. From New York, Luis.
Greetings, Utrees. That's Sarah from Dallas. Hello?
Louis from New York?
Is this Louis? Okay. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrees. How are you
Hello.
Today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'm going to say something that I have said before when I've called. It probably may not be too popular with some people. But I think there's a lot of introspection that needs to go on here in the black community. I mean, and this thing has taught me a couple of things, and that was your question. One of them is how ill-prepared we are to deal with something like this, and how distracted we are on other things. Now, along with what Alton Maddox pointed out about us not being indoctrinated anymore into pursuing things legally, we get distracted on the show, and I watched the funeral over the weekend, and Mr. Sharpton speaking and all these types of things. And it seems like people are just totally satisfied with that calm down, be peaceful attitude. And one thing I wanted to say is that we are too distracted with the show and the black community. We're too distracted with how we look. And I'm not going to point out any names at this funeral, but it's obvious we're too distracted with material things. And also, Utrees, I don't know if you heard this recording that came out of the shots that rang out.
Yes.
To kill Michael Brown.
Yes, I heard them.
It's about a 10 or 11 second recording of a guy who was in a nearby building who was on a Skype chat, I guess, with a female friend. And the moment he says, "You're so pretty," you hear these shots ring out. I mean, Utrees, I'm a gun owner, and I've been to the range many, many times. And the succession of shots in the first barrage of shots, it's like real quick succession. Pow, 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 pow. Now, mm-hmm. I know, as somebody who shot a gun before, if you're shooting that fast, there's no way you're aiming. Okay? This guy was running, I guess, across the road because he fell in the middle of the road. There's buildings in the background. There's all kinds of things. Then there's, after that, there's a, like a 2 or 3 second pause, and then there's pow, 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 four more shots. This means that this officer was so, his temper was boiling over so fast that he forgot everything he learned about shooting a weapon. He was so out of control that he didn't care who he hit. He just wanted to kill somebody. And it's obvious listening to that recording. And see, my point with that is, this is something I've never heard anybody mention since this recording came out a couple of days ago, is why is this guy shooting like this so fast and so erratically? And he's totally out of control, and we should have been, and the black community in that area, everybody was in danger that afternoon. Everybody. So as automatics would say, this is a legal matter that they should pursue as a class action. Everybody in that neighborhood should be pursuing this because their child could have been in the background. He could have shot through somebody's window and killed one of your children or yourself or whatever. And this right here shows how we just don't learn how to deal with these matters, and that's my point. What's your perspective on that?
Well, today, I mean, I'm listening, and it is an instruction in itself, just listening, and you have an extraordinary point. I did hear the tape of the two sets. There's a rapid shooting at six shots, you're right, and then there were four, possibly five others that came later, which suggests also that the officer had time to kind of assess the situation. And to assess not only the situation as it applied to Michael Brown, but to himself as the shooter. Do I really need to be this excessive in shooting? Or why the need to add five more shots after the first six? So it is a very important question, but, you know, communities are generally not prepared to ask these questions. What do we do when we as a community find ourselves under assault or possibly under assault by an out-of-control police officer? It just is, mm-hmm. It is just not one of the things that comes up. So that is one of the things now to consider, and I thank you for bringing it to our attention today. Thanks so much for your call.
You have a great afternoon,
Eutrice. Thank you. Luis, good to have you back again.
Yes, what I would like to do is just make a quick reference to an observation to a historical point. Albert Einstein gave a lecture at Lincoln University, and I believe it was in May 1946. And part of that lecture was on racism in the United States. And briefly what he said was that racism is not a colored disease, that racism is a white disease, and that racism is an American disease. And he ended by stating that colored people were treated in the United States the same way that Jews were being treated in Germany at this time. I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Sarah from Dallas, you're on the air.
Greetings, Eutrice.
Hello.
Yes, Eutrice. I have to agree with what X from L.A. Started off stating in regards to this police officer. Because he was reckless in his discharge of his firearm. And believe that when the crime scene investigators came on the scene, they retrieved a bullet out of an apartment building where one of these bullets went in. One of these bullets went into that apartment building. And that is indeed reckless because someone who's also trained in firearms, and I also trained other people to use firearms, I know that that's a reckless disregard of the use of firearms. And someone like himself who's in law enforcement, that is something you need to have control. You don't need to be coming out, especially when you're firing a weapon, you have to control your breathing, and you have to also control your grasp as well as your trigger. Because that is probably why, because I counted, I also heard a tape, and I counted at least between 10 to 11 shots. So if it's a clip that holds 12 rounds,
that would account for him emptying his clip, because if he said one of it went off in his vehicle and then he used the other 11 of it on this fleeing child, then he emptied his clip and only managed to hit 6 times. Well, maybe 5 or 6 times. It all depends on if they have a reentry wound from one of the bullets that hit the child and then came back out and then create another puncture wound. The whole thing with this situation, Utrice, is a couple callers were saying about laws and everything else. When you have an unjust and uncivilized people who create laws within which to protect themselves, and this matter is not just restricted towards the United States only. It's a global system. White supremacy is a global system because you go anywhere, you find the same problem. You go to Australia where the blacks are, the aborigine over there, they were also genocide, and they were also taken off their land, and they are treated atrociously over, just like black people are over here. You go in the UK, you go in the Caribbean, you go on the African continent, everywhere you go where we are, you find we are, and whites are there also, you find it's the same situation. So we need not to just localize it just to the United States. It's a United States problem. It's a global problem that has gotten out of control and has gotten out of hand, because the people who put together this system, slavery was not only just the British, it was all the entire Western European nation who were part of it, from the Danes to the people from the Dutch, the Germans, you name it, they were all a part of this and they all benefit from the system. So we need not try and localize it. But as you said, with what you're saying, in order to make a class action, it just goes to show this ineffectiveness when we like to say about voting, and we always like to come back on blaming the people. Okay, they didn't get out and vote, and it's therefore their problem. Voting is not going to get black people where we need to go. We need to get off this kick. We have been on this stuff for 50 years, and we need to stop using it as a panacea, as an excuse. You need to do other things in conjunction with voting. And our problem is that we put all of our eggs into this voting basket, and we don't want to see and do anything else. We are not looking at financial infrastructure or any other things that we need to put in place. We all want to concentrate on voting. But you look at the other communities, and you're seeing one of the first things that they do when they come over here, the first thing they do is they get their financial houses in order. From the Koreans to the Chinese to the Japanese to whoever they are, they try to get economically self-sufficient so they are not going to be dependent on the dominant system within which to employ them and within which that they're going to be deriving most of their economic gains from through a job. Black people are not doing that. Most of these other communities, the majority of them employ their own people. We are not. We're the total opposite. Most of us are employed outside of our community, and that is something we're going to have to reverse if we want to be viable as a people. Because when the same people that you want to go up and control your food supply, your education, as well as your paycheck, then a lot of people are not going to go there and protest because, oh, I'm worried about my job. My boss might see me. I got to hide my face, disguise my voice, and all this other stuff, which we have to do because I don't want to get fired from my job. But if you're working for people within your community, you are all open and all going through the same thing, you wouldn't have this problem, because you would realize that this is something we are all fighting together in order to rectify it. And the last few truths I'm going to say is because of people who always want to say that, okay, that I'm talking hate and I'm being stressful. No, I'm not being hateful. I am just repeating what has been done to us, this system. And if I'm just the reporter of the news, that don't make me hater. I'm just reporting what has already been done. And if people don't like to hear what's being said by me, and you want to close your ears and bury your head and pretend it does not exist, it is not going to change the system. It is not going to change it. And sometimes it's a hard truth, because when we get chastised by our parents, sometimes we hate being chastised. But sometimes it's for the benefit of your own, because my parents, when they used to chastise me, they used to go back and repeat all the things that I did in the past, coming up to this moment where they have to finally go ahead and give me this weapon. And I used to get mad about it, but they said, you know, we missed you all of these times, but I'm going to go back and give you a record of what you've done coming up to this moment. And this is what America needs to do. America needs to always be showing her dirty laundry in her face, because she likes to go around the globe and like to pretend that everybody, this is a democracy that they're running over here, everybody is treated fair and equality. But it's not, you know, Little Ferguson, Missouri, has shown on the map to show America the hypocrisy to everybody else that they're going out and dominating. You are not doing what you try to run out here and tell the rest of us to do, because look how your citizens are being treated over there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, Sarah, for your call today. From D.C., Mike, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hello. How are you?
Well, and
so
I,
what is
I knew
Ferguson
I would be
teaching
following,
you?
Sarah's call, because the tenor of her message, I'm going to essentially echo it, but I'm going to try to crystallize it a little bit, because what she said was so on point, and most people don't want to recognize the fact that most of us don't want to deal with the truth and the reality, because, you know, we've been conditioned to kind of like not deal with things on a real level. But everybody knows that as far as African-American people concerned, Africans, whatever you want to call them, African life, a color, particularly the darker you are, the less your life is perceived to be worth. That's reality. And it's reflected all over the planet, like the sister was saying. What we've seen in Ferguson is beautiful. And the reason I say it's beautiful, because it's almost like that movie, The Matrix, where they talk about a crack in the fabric of the Matrix or a blip in the Matrix. That's what Ferguson represented. Ferguson represented a small dose of reality for the world to see, and that's why it's resonated with so many people all over the planet, because they know that white supremacy rules us all, not claim it's white supremacy that rules us all. And unless we develop a systemic response to a systemic institution, what we will continue to have are just these little small blips in the matrix. And
what is a systemic response, Mike?
Well, in my opinion, in order to counteract a force, you need a countervailing force, a contravailing force, whatever. You need something that's going to come at it equally hard. And the only way the masses can do that is through unity. The unity is what terrifies the power structure, because just like COINTELPRO was developed to prevent the rise of a unifying messiah within the black community, according to the FBI and Hoover, I think the unity is what frightens the system. When you can get people to act in concert, to move in one accord, it can change the course of history. We've seen that.
Unity among whom? Or with whom?
You need unity among humans. You need unity among people who are clear thinking and who are lucid, people who are not coerced and being misguided by the system and the benefits of the system. Most white people are good people, but they refuse to deny the benefits that are being given to them as a result of the system. And that is what keeps the unity from occurring. If the majority of good white people start, like they did in the 60s, to eschew the benefits of the system in order to unify with the downtrodden, that's when you're going to have that traction. But, you know, like I said, as long as we have these little blips, the little blips are going to serve notice to the system, and the system is going to respond just as they did in Ferguson, you know what I mean? But one other thing I want to say before I close, Ms. Lees, there's an economic component to this that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar hit on in a piece in New York Times, and a lot of people dismiss that. But the kids in Ferguson were absolutely saying, we have no stake in this system. This system does not employ us. These people who own these businesses do not live in our community. They don't look like us. We have no educational opportunities. There's no way to express our artistic side. You've taken the music from us. There's no rec centers for us to get rid of our excess energy through exercise. So therefore, we will respond in the way that we deem fit, not how you want us to respond. And that's why I said it was beautiful. So the economic part has to be recognized. We got to get off of this money thing and realize that all real value is derived from humans, from us. We are our own economy. If we unify, and I'm working on this right now, this is going to be the rest of my life's mission, is working on trying to unify people to provide their own economics and not look outside of themselves.
Very profound. Thank you so much for that, Mike. Thank you for calling today.
Sure.
From the Bronx, Linda, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
I enjoyed all of the other callers that have spoken, and I think economics is totally key. We really need some new direction. I didn't see the funeral on television, but when I heard that they had told people to vote and they use it as a platform, I was really disgusted with that. And then whenever a leader, whether it's Al Sharpton or whatever, whenever they say we need more jobs, I have problems with that also, because our focus has to be economics. And there's a book that just came out about 2 months ago. It's called Collective Courage by Jessica Nimhart, Jessica Gord Nimhart. It's an incredible book. She has done extensive research on our economic history. And so much of that I didn't know anything about. And I learned so much from that book that we even brought her to Harlem to discuss that. Because we know about our civil rights movement, but our economic history. And I think it's an important book, and it's important that we study this so we won't have people running around making comments like we don't stick together when we did stick together, and how that was all eroded and destroyed when we had cooperatives, when we owned supermarkets, when we had our own stores. I mean, it was, and not only did we have a cooperative movement, there was a global populist movement. So what happened to all that? And I think that's part of the solutions. We have to build our own economic community. We still got to deal with the oppressive issues. But if I think if our economics is stronger, we'll just be better off.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Thank you, Linda, for your call today.
Okay, and thank you, Eutrice.
Thank you so much. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
All right.
What is Ferguson teaching you?
Well, not going to be too long. Ferguson basically is teaching me that if this issue isn't resolved systematically, something worse is going to happen the next time another Ferguson comes around. I just keep getting these images of, okay, if we let the system get away with murdering, you know, a young black armed man with no provocation or any penalty or justice, I'm afraid the next time this type of situation happens, we might see something what we saw in Soweto, South Africa, where cops just start firing on children, you know, and I'm just afraid that, you know, that's the next, you know, thing that we're going to see if nothing gets resolved from this. So, you know, as a people, we have to really, really stick with this, because if we don't get this solved now, something worse is going to come down the line. So just worried about, you know, us dropping the ball on this one. So we won't have a Soweto massacre happening the next time, you know, something like this happens. I mean, that's all I want.
But what would you suggest be put in place?
Well, first of all, the basic minimum justice needs to be done with the police officers, you know, being arrested and put into the system, you know, for what's done. I mean, you know, police should not be exempt from when they take a life, you know, for no apparent reason, especially if their lives were in danger. They should be held accountable just like any other citizen. So I mean, that's the first thing that I would, you know, that needs to be done. But that hasn't even happened yet.
And then?
And then at that point, we have to make sure that these people get prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And then at that point, we need to have a conversation about how police, you know, deal with people, you know, within our own, you know, communities. I mean, I don't know how that's going to go down. I don't have a solid answer for it or a plan for it. But it's a conversation that just basically needs to happen. And something after that conversation needs to be done.
Thank you very much, Henry, for your contribution today. From Malika, from New York, sorry, Malika.
Hi. Hi, Eugene.
Hello. Hello. What are your thoughts today? What is Ferguson teaching you?
It's teaching me that we really have to come together as people to wake up, because it makes people realize that the things that we need to do now is like community organizing, like just going to your meetings with the mayors, town hall meetings, putting out applications on your own, planning little meetings in your homes, putting out flyers, and, seeing exactly what's happening. I mean, we have to make people realize you can't keep doing the same thing, like voting for Democrats or Republicans, because it's a sign of insanity. Nothing ever changes. And people have to start realizing that you have to be independent, start voting for yourself, put up your own candidates and back them, or just support them because of the money thing going on with the whole situation of the government owned by the corporate. We have to just start basically saying, look, they're not going to make the same mistakes as the past. We're not going to keep on going to funerals. We're not going to keep going to the same system that has been oppressing us. We're going to make our own system. But we're going to be inclusive of everybody who is going to truly be people who want to see everyone have this glow of free, being free. Because, believe me, they're not going to only stop with us. Because the elites are going to go for anybody who's not billionaires, trillionaires, and it's going to trickle on from that. Because it's not only us anymore. It's going to happen to everybody, and everybody has to wake up. But right now, it's us on the red line. We have to do this now. We have to say, this is enough. Let's just, in all our little communities, just go out every meeting. We can even plan meetings and go out and just start educating people. One, each one, teach one. That's what we have to do, because we have to stand up. I mean, PTA, I mean, teachers' meetings. And everybody has to talk to and get in the same, on the same mindset that we can do this if we are the people who are going to stand up and say, enough of this. We're not paying police and giving our tax money for them to harm us. And they don't talk about white on white crime, but they talk about black on black crime. And that's a problem. But you have to go through the whole spectrum, because we're not the only ones.
Thank you, Malika, for your call today. From New Jersey, Anna, you're on the air.
Hello, Eugene.
Hello. Hello.
I've been paying attention to how everyone in, I guess in the United States, I think we have like some type of amnesia, because when Amadou Diallo was shot, 41 shots or probably more, and all these other people before the year 2000 occurred, we had the attorney general that was involved, and the current attorney general that was involved and didn't do anything about it. And the same thing happening here, where in Ferguson you have people so excited that we have this attorney general involved, like the case is going to be solved. And I think the problem with us is that we don't really know our history in this country. And it's very important that we, continue with learning how to deal with our plight in this country, constant education, learning about the economy, how to become self-sufficient. However, the other caller said that we were self-sufficient, and what happened with that? Is it that we are at war, or how is it that we're going to survive? Because we did it before, in Tulsa and other places in the United States, and we were decimated economically. So I think there has to be something that we have to recognize our plight in this country, because I don't think it's going to get better whether we're educated or not, from what I'm seeing.
All right. Well, you have to leave it there. I'm afraid, Anna, we're out of time. But thank you so much for your call.
No problem.
That brings us to the end of our program today, and I hope that this allowed us to begin the process of trading ideas and opinions and thoughts about what this is supposed to be. This is supposed to be an instructive time. It is still evolving, but it's supposed to allow us to really reflect on what this is supposed to instruct us to do and to be in this time. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Wolff with Economic Update. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. As always, I want to thank you very, very sincerely for the pleasure and the great privilege of your company. See you tomorrow.